me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, the latest on health and healing and something new from the little old crab apple that nobody ever eats. Something good. Always the latest on health and healing, cutting-edge material from quality universities published in peer-reviewed literature. Then we're going to look at the truth. I didn't have a chance to deal with it day before yesterday. I will deal with new information about how we got into the mess in Afghanistan and have been there for 17 years, costing billions of dollars, thousands of American lives, hundreds of thousands of Afghani lives. Why? And much like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, we would later find out, and McNamara conceded this in his film, the Academy Award-winning film by Mr. Norris on The Fog of War, that it wasn't true. The American ships were not attacked and torpedoed, and there was no justification for military intervention. There was no domino effect, all lies. And then the truth about going into Iraq, all lies. The truth about the regime change in Syria, that how Syria and Assad was killing their own civilians who were part of the Arab Spring, lies. Those were provocateurs from Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and the United States and France and Great Britain. And then the destruction of Libya. All lies. So will we have the courage and the temerity of character to stop and say, we keep being lied to by people in power with devastating consequences? Here's the truth about that, and you'll hear that right after Health and Nutrition. And then we're going to segue from that, directly from that, we're going to go into, it's official, we're living in a prequel to Blade Runner. I'm just very concerned about the downside of artificial intelligence, which is smarter than any human, it can do anyone's work. I'm even more concerned about transhumanism. I'm concerned what this will do when we're already losing jobs and we're being controlled because we're an economic asset. So we're going to play those two back to back. All right? But first, we start with the latest. And the latest starts with the crabapple. Now, crabapple supplements could help cut cholesterol. This according to Beijing and Shanghai universities. And the crabapple extract has been shown to lower cholesterol in this laboratory experiment, especially where there's a high-fat diet. Well, Americans have a high-fat diet. So do the English, and so do the French. And so we can benefit from this. So hypercholesterolemia, which is an elevated cholesterol, the crabapple has been used for treating diarrhea, indigestion, and other digestive diseases in traditional Chinese medicine. It's a very powerful antioxidant. It's not good to eat, but boy, it's good for you. And this was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Functional Foods. Now, in addition to that, there is a University of Luxembourg study about altered microbiome after cesarean section impacts a baby's immune system. So together with colleagues from Sweden and Luxembourg, scientists from the Luxembourg Center for Systems Biomedicine of the University of Luxembourg have observed that during a natural vaginal birth, specific bacteria from the mother's gut are passed on to the baby and stimulate the baby's natural immune system. And that's good. And this transmission is impacted with children born by cesarean section. Quote, this may explain why, epidemiologically speaking, cesarean-born children suffer more frequent from chronic immune system-linked diseases compared to babies born vaginally. And this was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Nature Communications. Remember, humans are born germ-free, yet birth is normally the time when the vitally important bacteria start to colonize the body, including the gut, the skin, and the lungs. So researchers have long suspected that this early colonization sets the course of one's later health. And it could be, however, that a cesarean section prevents certain bacteria ordinarily interacting with the baby's immune system from being passed on from the mother to the newborn. And as a result, this is what we see. So this bacterial colonizer immune system link, together with other factors, could explain why cesarean section babies are statistically more prone to develop allergies and chronic inflammatory conditions and metabolic diseases. So quite simply, this is bad. Now here's what's even worse. I remember in 1975, on my radio program, having a Dr. Tom Brewer and his wife Gail Brewer. She was a nurse midwife, and he was an obstetrician, gynecologist. And they were advocating for natural childbirth and nurse midwifery, and they were up against this whole medical establishment in New York State that was fighting them because it makes more money for the hospital, for the obstetrician, if you have a hospital birth. And yet, when you have a nurse midwife, you have lower death rates, lower infection rates, low post-birth infections, and therefore it's much healthier. And they would cite studies. And yet, all this was because the political context, because of who was running Albany in the medical community. And I've met those people, by the way, some years ago when they were going to make it mandatory that every medical person working in any medical facility, including even outpatients, had to be vaccinated with four different vaccines. And none of this was necessary, but all of these vaccines contain 24 micrograms of mercury. That's 5,000% more than what the body should have, that is even by the federal guidelines considered safe. And there are over 1,000 studies that I collected from toxicological peer-reviewed journals, including in the Library of Medicine, that showed that mercury is a neurotoxin. And they use mercury as an adjuvant, which is meant to take some active ingredient and make it more powerful. So we were given notice that this was going to be passed with real no debate. And when we called around to all the physicians, at least physicians that I know, no one even knew this was coming up. So on the air, I said, let's go up to Albany. And we only had 24 hours. But in that 24 hours, we managed to organize a whole car caravan. We had buses. We had artists come with charts, you know, to make up art signs. And we got up there. There was no one there. The media was there because we showed up, about 1,300 of us showed up in Albany. I even had one van come up that we had the night before prepared all this food. I didn't know how many people were going to come, but I prepared food for 1,000 people. And so we had juices, and we really organized it well. And so there we are on the steps, and sure enough, you knew that there were agent provocateurs there because they came with signs that clearly were meant to cause people to pay attention to them. So needless to say, when you have someone who's trying to gear the media towards them and away from the main message, then you're going to have problems. And so I went over to him and I said, what is the purpose of you being here? Oh, because we're concerned about this. But you're advocating, you know, that a very destructive message. And there's Fox Media, there's Bloomberg, another major media. They're going to come over because you're the most radicalized, but not the most sensible and not the one message that is going to help us. Is that what you intend to do? Are you here to sabotage the efforts? People don't realize how many saboteurs are in every movement. And we, from Freedom of Information Act, we found out that the FBI has every single demonstration in America covered. And so anyhow, some of the other people went over and talked with him, and one of the artists gave this person a different sign. And the sign asked the question, how much mercury can a person's body tolerate before it becomes biochemically compromised? And the answer was any amount of mercury. And you're giving 5,000 times the amount a body can tolerate? Well, what was interesting, there were no doctors there, nor nurses. There were people from my audience, and that was it. So I'd flown people in, including Dr. Eisenstein from Chicago. We had about six physicians, and they all got up on the Capitol steps and spoke. Then, and I spoke, and then we demanded to hear from the Commissioner of Health. And these are always all pro, ultra-Orthodox medical people. So we were invited in. So there was Michael Schachter, myself, and our attorney. So we went in and we met with these three, and boy, they did not look happy with that meeting. And I said, I have compiled a list of peer-reviewed medical literature on the dangers of these vaccines. One vaccine is dangerous, and you want to give four. And so here's the justification not to give it. Could you please show me your evidence from peer-reviewed literature of why it would benefit and protect these people? They couldn't. They didn't have anything. They had nothing. So they took the 119 pages that we gave them, and then we managed to get them to agree to public hearings. And at the public hearings, they bring you up to testify under oath based upon the number of when you sign up, your first or 10th or 12th. I was there an hour before they opened. I signed up first. They took me dead last. I sat there for about, I think it was around 10 hours. And when the media was gone, and that dog and pony show comes, when only the Orthodox people are then the media hears the Orthodox. They won't listen to anyone else. And thank goodness there was someone, I was told a physician, who was there, and he filmed me with his telephone. I didn't know this. And I posted this. You want to see this? You want to see how I deal with the medical community and legislators under oath? Go up to YouTube and download that. I don't know what it's called, something about me testifying in New York State public health hearings on the mandatory vaccine. And for 22 minutes, and I ripped him right up the middle. You know, be that as it may, I just want to share that with you because we shouldn't be having cesarean section. And the very people who sit at the state level and the federal level telling us, oh, cesareans are increasing and that's good, it's not. There's higher death, there's higher all kinds of effects in the surgery. Not just now we know from to the mother, but also to the developing child, the baby. But if we can't get their attention, then they're not going to change. And finally, a lack of sleep is costing the U.S. economy $400 billion a year. This is from the RAND Corporation. Yeah, a lack of sleep among U.S. working population is costing the economy $400 billion with a B. That's almost 3% of the gross domestic product. And also, when you have sleep deprivation, it leads to a higher death risk and a lower productivity levels in the workplace. So that's important, and we should be paying attention to that, and we're not. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. Now we're going to take a break and come right back from the break right into what's happening that we don't know, and how could it impact us? Are we approaching, you know, Blade Runner?
I've brought it up multiple times in past videos, but only because it's so on point. In his novel 1984, George Orwell wrote of a future where, quote, nothing was your own except the few cubic centimeters inside your skull.
It's kind of crazy today that we live quite comfortably in a world that George Orwell would have thought is super crazy.
But we're living in a world right now where billions of dollars are being spent to try and decode our brains, where arguments are being made everywhere from Davos.
You know, the brain is a spatiotemporal device, right? It's a blob of meat, yeah, that computes.
To Scientific American, that the Bill of Rights doesn't cover what they are now calling cognitive liberty. Sophisticated neuroimaging machines and brain-to-computer interfaces that can detect the electrical activity of neurons enable us to decode and even alter the nervous system signals that accompany mental processes. And that protections of our inherent rights need to be put in place before the technology outpaces our ability to do so, which it is. This is something that scientists have actually been calling for since at least the 60s. And it seems like it's if by design that they've just been turning a deaf ear to that for the last, 60 years. In the last video I put up, I discussed how science has come to the basic conclusion in the last half a century that we really are run by signals. Signals on a person-to-person level, signals from our five senses continuously building our reality, and signals all the way down to the cellular level controlling our gene expression. Where science is taking this, with cybernetic systems of communication and control, I just don't think the average person has any idea of where we're about to go as a society with this. Princeton professor Sebastian Sung, who used to be a computational neuroscience professor at MIT, wrote a book back in 2013 claiming that the way the 100 billion neurons and regions in our brains are wired creates and shapes our identity and our personality.
And perhaps other aspects of your personal identity, maybe your personality and your intellect, maybe they're also encoded in the connections between your neurons. And so now you can see why I proposed this hypothesis, I am my connectome.
In other words, he says what he calls our connectome is actually who we are.
All together now, I am my connectome.
And he has a very new agey website, and in the same transhumanist fashion as much of today's cutting edge science, he says that if we can just conquer our brains, then we can change ourselves for the better, inferring that we can rewire our brains to make ourselves better people. And after quoting Arthur C. Clarke that any sufficient technology is indistinguishable from magic, he goes on to make the claim that information is the new soul. So now our information is our soul. This is information which everything in the scientific world after World War II sought to control in every way possible.
Information is collected, data is gathered, the information is sent out by teletype signals of the target operations.
So now they're saying that our information is our soul. That's them saying it, by the way. I didn't say that. This is what a computational neuroscientist from MIT, who now is a professor at Princeton and is quoted in the New York Times about how our information is us and all this stuff. This is what they're trying. This is now how science is moving along under models such as this. That is what I'm trying to show you. I'm not even going to go off on the side tangent about how they've been trying to use science and the precursors to science to get to the soul for hundreds of years now. But again, I will just say that all of this cutting-edge neuroscience tech that they're rushing to create, when they reported on it in the MIT Tech Review magazine several years back, they called it hacking your soul. So it makes it very obvious that that's the level that they're aiming for. They're aiming for something much more than just understanding your brain and how your brain works, which they still, in many ways, don't, even today. So I know it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway, that if your reality is created through signals received externally through your senses, and those signals can in any way be altered, then reality, your reality can be altered. Because if perceptions and signals from perceptions can run reality, then misperceptions can too. All of this new neurotech, a lot of it is coming out of the Brain Initiative that President Obama announced in 2014. Which is co-planned by someone from Rockefeller University, just like MKUltra itself was largely funded and influenced by the Rockefellers back in the day. The word BRAIN in Brain Initiative actually stands for Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies. And I know it sounds like a crappy thing to say, but I'm gonna say it anyways, that these advances always begin with a foot in the door on something that almost everyone can get behind. Like helping quadriplegics to communicate with brain-computer interfaces. But once that door is open an inch for a good reason, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And we know it won't be long before the door gets kicked off the hinges. I mean, companies like Facebook are working on tech to allow users to type with their thoughts, which Facebook claims they're only going to read the thoughts that you've decided you want to share.
We're talking about decoding those words, the ones you've already decided to share, by sending them to the speech center of your brain.
So go ahead and trust them on that, I guess. That's sarcasm. Scientists are implanting false memories into mice now, which is also very Blade Runner.
You think I'm a replicant, don't you? It's me with my mother.
They're talking about creating tech that can turn our sleep on and off.
But when safer techniques are developed for humans, we could potentially turn sleep on and off at will.
In other words, your consciousness, like a light switch. I mean, it all sounds like science fiction to an 80s kid like me, but this is the stuff they're actually doing right now. I mean, DARPA's working on putting EEG readers in every classroom and building devices that can record from a million neurons and stimulate a targeted 100,000 neurons based on what it records. They want read and write access to your brain like it's a computer. That is what they're going for with this stuff. Which brings me to this new research that was just published a few weeks ago out of the University of California, San Francisco. Researchers funded by DARPA's SubNETS program, which stands for Systems-Based Neurotechnology for Emerging Therapies, claim they've now identified a common pattern of brain activity that's linked to feelings of low mood. They say they've located what they believe is a single signal that almost completely accounts for bouts of depressed mood in a large subset of people. And so they're claiming that if they can target that signal with new technological therapies, they could help those people's brains unlearn the detrimental signaling pattern that creates depression. Is that something that we should be doing? Isn't there a reason why we have these emotions? Why would we think that there's not going to be any negative ramifications for eradicating them? They don't really know a lot about how the brain works, and they're tinkering with it on this level. We'll just go to the signal in your brain that causes depression, and we'll just eradicate that signal. We'll have you unlearn that signal. I don't know about you guys, but when I heard that, my mind immediately went to Philip K. Dick land and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which is the story that the Blade Runner films are based on. Within the first few pages of this story, the characters, which is Rick Deckard, who is the character that Harrison Ford played in the original Blade Runner, and his wife, are arguing about what to dial on something they have called a Pinfield mood organ, which can make them feel any emotion they want to on demand. And they're getting into an argument about it because he's saying she set her dial too weak and he wants to reset it. And she's saying, keep your hand off my settings. And they start to have a fight. And he's saying at his console, he's hesitating between dialing for a thalamic suppressant, which would abolish his angry mood, or a thalamic stimulant, which would make him feel angry enough to win the argument. And she's saying, if you dial for greater venom, I will dial the same, I'll dial the maximum, and you'll see a fight that makes every argument we've had up until now seem like nothing. Dial and try me, right? She says, my schedule for today lists a 6-hour self-accusatory depression. And he's saying, what? That's, why would you put that? Why would you dial that mood on purpose? It defeats the whole purpose of having a mood organ. And he says, I didn't even know you could set it for that. And she explains all of this about how she was confronted with a very depressing situation, but she just felt empty. She didn't feel anything because her moods are so jacked up. And she said, but it's unhealthy not to feel anything. It used to be considered a sign of mental illness. They called it absence of appropriate effect, to not feel anything when you're confronted with a depressing situation. So twice a month now, she's been putting this self-accusatory depression on her schedule so she can feel what should be an appropriate emotion about a bad situation. And he's saying, why don't you just dial 888, the desire to watch TV no matter what's on it? And she said, I don't want to dial anything now. And he says, well, then dial a 3. And she says, I can't dial a setting that stimulates my cerebral cortex into wanting to dial. If I don't want to dial, I don't want to dial that the most of all, because then I will want to dial, and wanting to dial is the most alien drive I can imagine. I just want to sit here on the bed and stare at the floor. This scene between them ends when he says, I'll dial for both of us, and he dials a 594 for her, which is pleased acknowledgement of husband's superior wisdom in all matters. I mean, in a situation like this, what is reality? What is real anymore? What if you're not, if you don't have authentic emotions, if you aren't appropriately emotionally responding to what's going on in your life and the relationships you have with people, is any of it real at all? I mean, first of all, if you're depressed, most likely there are things going on in your life that's contributing to your depression. And if you can just mess with the signals in your brain to not feel the appropriate mood, that doesn't change what's happening in your environment that contributed to that mood in the first place. So now you're just walking around happy in the worst possible situation, or in a very bad one. In that sense, you could be happy with anything, because you won't have the appropriate emotions that are there to help you react and respond to what's happening in your environment. And if they can do it with that, so are they going to dial love too? I mean, will anything in your life be real if it can all be synthetically dialed using machines that just replicate or inhibit signals in your brain? And that's the whole beginning of this short story about androids dreaming of electric sheep. And in that way, we would become like androids, because they can just mess with the signals in your brain. If you're just messing with signals in your brain, and that doesn't have anything to do with authentically living your life and responding to your signals in your actual environment. That just has to do with whatever, I guess, whatever you want. Just toy with your brain. Just turn your brain on and off like a machine. Philip K. Dick named this the Pinfield mood organ, specifically after Dr. Wilder Pinfield. He was a Rhodes Scholar who was trained at Oxford under Sir Charles Sherrington and went on to work at McGill University with Rockefeller Foundation funding. He was mentoring MKUltra contractors at that place, and he was working literally a block down the street from other notorious MKUltra researchers who were also Rockefeller funded, like Dr. Ewan Cameron of Subproject 68 out of the Allen Memorial Institute. I mean, this isn't just anybody that he chose to name, that Philip K. Dick chose to name this device after. It's named after somebody who was doing experimental research on people with deep brain electrodes and queuing up their memories and their emotions, and it goes on and on from there. So Wilder Pinfield, he takes up a pretty decent chunk of time in our film, because it's very important to understand what this man was doing and really how we got to where we are today in society, where they're talking about even creating a technology to train your brain to unlearn certain signals, started with MKUltra. And we talk about all of this extensively in our film. That film has direct bearing on today. That's why I keep bringing it up, because the world that we're stepping into right now comes out of the stuff they were doing at that time. And the New Brain Initiative might as well be MKUltra 3.0 at this point. The technology we do have at hand is already making people apathetic as it is. I mean, what happens when somebody gets hurt in public now? A lot of people just pull out their phones and film it. They don't react or respond as empathetic human beings normally do in a situation where they see somebody get hurt. So what's that going to look like down the road when we have technology changing our emotions to fit our whims and not to fit our actual reality? We're living, basically, in the prequel to Blade Runner. In more ways than just this, actually. This is where they're taking society. A place where you can I guess, dial back emotions you don't want, or use computers to unlearn emotions that you have for a reason. You have these emotions for a reason. We're not all just crazy, that we're all just walking around and can't control our emotions. I'm not saying there aren't people who are, but the average person who's depressed is, there's reasons for that. It isn't just like, well, that's a bad emotion, just eradicate it. I don't know. When I saw that, I had to share. I can't even keep...
That was very insightful. Now let's go to something that should be a sobering moment. New information about the real reasons we're in Afghanistan. This is as important to the Afghan war as the Pentagon Papers published by the New York Times and the Washington Post were for the Vietnam War.
Yet another surge of violence in Afghanistan, including suicide bombings by the Taliban and retaliatory airstrikes by U.S. forces, is reminding the world once again of the fact that the Afghan war is far from over.
In Afghanistan, a fierce battle is continuing over the control of the strategic city of Ghazni 4 days after the Taliban attacked the city, killing more than 200 people, including over 100 soldiers and police officers. Many residents have fled the city.
Ghazni morphed into an urban battlefield last Friday. People were trapped for 5 days in their homes as thousands of Taliban fighters and Afghan soldiers fought in the streets. U.S. helicopters, drones, and a B-1 bomber patrolled overhead.
In Afghanistan, Taliban fighters overran a military base, killing at least 17 soldiers. They attacked the site in northern Faryab province and claimed dozens of soldiers surrendered.
The horrific attack is a clear effort to foment sectarian violence and hold back the Afghan people's hopes for a future of peace and security. It reminds us once again the importance of reaching a peaceful solution to the conflict in Afghanistan. The United States continues to stand with the government of Afghanistan and the people of Afghanistan and will continue to support their efforts to achieve peace and security in their country.
Peace and security. For 17 years now, the American people and the people of the world have listened to the U.S. State Department tell us how the American military is working to bring peace and security to Afghanistan. But this lie is self-refuting. At 17 years, the Afghan War is now the longest war in American history. And despite recent reports about negotiations between the U.S. and the Taliban, the deployment of troops in the country has actually increased in the Trump era.
Breaking news on the nation's long war in Afghanistan. President Trump in a primetime address declaring the U.S. must continue the fight.
The consequences of a rapid exit are both predictable and unacceptable.
And while he didn't commit to a specific number of additional troops, although he said we would see overwhelming force, the president has given Defense Secretary Mattis the authority to set troop levels, and Mattis has favored sending in about 4,000 more U.S. troops.
But as the U.S. falls deeper and deeper into the Afghan quagmire, we risk forgetting how this war was actually authorized. The public is merely reminded, in Pavlovian fashion, that
9/11, the worst terrorist attack in our history, was planned and directed from Afghanistan.
But how was that determination made? Who made it? When? And how did NATO become involved in this conflict? These details are never discussed because they have, for nearly two decades, been hidden behind a shroud of secrecy. As we shall see, the entire war was waged on a false pretense based on supposed evidence that was classified and withheld from the public. But now, after nearly two decades of lies, the remarkable truth about the secret documents that helped launch the Afghan war can finally be revealed. This is the story of the secret lie that started the Afghan war. You're watching The Corbett Report. Just 1 day after 9/11, while the toxic dust was still settling on Ground Zero, the North Atlantic Council, NATO's decision-making body, met to discuss NATO's response to the attacks.
On September the 12th, the North Atlantic Council met again. in response to the appalling attacks perpetrated yesterday against the United States of America. The Council agreed that if it is determined that this attack was directed from abroad against the United States, it shall be regarded as an action covered by Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, which states that an armed attack against one or more of the Allies in Europe or in North America shall be considered an attack against them all. Article 5 of the Washington Treaty stipulates that in the event of attacks falling within its purview, each ally will assist the party that has been attacked by taking such action as it deems necessary. Accordingly, the United States NATO allies stand ready to provide the assistance that may be required as a consequence of these acts of barbarism.
The Washington Treaty, more formally known as the North Atlantic Treaty, is the founding document of NATO. Consisting of 14 articles, it lays out the obligations of the signatory nations to their fellow NATO members. Article 5 states that the parties agree that an armed attack against one or more of them in Europe or North America shall be considered an attack against them all, and consequently they agree that if such an armed attack occurs, each of them, in exercise of the right of individual or collective self-defense recognized by Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations, will assist the party or parties so attacked by taking forthwith, individually and in concert with the other parties, such action as it deems necessary, including the use of armed force, to restore and maintain the security of the North Atlantic area. That the North Atlantic Council discussed the invocation of Article 5 on September 12, 2001, is no small matter. It had never been invoked in the history of NATO up to that point, and its invocation would commit NATO forces to whatever war the U.S. launched in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. But who directed those 9/11 attacks? That was the question, and, as Lord Robertson indicated, it would require the U.S. to demonstrate that the attack was directed from abroad. On October 2, 2001, the U.S. government's official answer to that question was provided by Ambassador Frank Taylor, the United States Department of State Coordinator for Counterterrorism. On that day, Taylor briefed the North Atlantic Council on Al-Qaeda's alleged connection to the events of 9/11.
This morning, the United States briefed the North Atlantic Council on the results of their investigation into who was responsible for the horrific terrorist attacks which took place on the 11th of September. The briefing addressed the events of 11th September themselves, the results of the investigation so far, what is known about Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda organization and their involvement in the attacks, and in previous terrorist activity, and the links between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. The facts are clear and compelling. The information presented points conclusively to an Al-Qaeda role in the 11th of September attacks.
So clear and compelling was Taylor's briefing that the Council agreed to invoke Article 5 and commit NATO's forces to the U.S. government's war of terror.
On the basis of this briefing, it has now been determined that the attack against the United States of America on the 11th of September was directed from abroad and shall therefore be regarded as an action covered by Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, which states that an armed attack on one or more of the Allies in Europe or North America shall be considered as an attack against them all. I want to reiterate yet again today that the United States of America can rely on the full support of its 18 NATO allies in the campaign against international terrorism.
And, just like that, NATO members were committed to an operation in Afghanistan that sees their troops remaining in the country to this very day. So what information did Ambassador Taylor present in that briefing? The 9/11 Commission, which would go on to deliver the official government conspiracy theory of 9/11 in its 2004 final report, still had not even been established. In fact, the establishment of such a commission was at that time still being actively blocked by the Bush administration. and the mistranslated tape that the Pentagon would later falsely label the Osama bin Laden confession tape had still not been magically discovered in a random house in Jalalabad. At this point, there had been no official evidence presented to the public that demonstrated that the operation was directed and coordinated from Afghanistan by Al-Qaeda. Surely, then, the Taylor briefing would be filled with evidence that would put to rest any
outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
But there's just one problem. The Taylor report was classified, and any evidence it contained showing an Al-Qaeda link to 9/11 was hidden from the public.
Today's was a classified briefing, so I cannot give you all the details. Briefings are also being given directly by the United States to allies in the capitals.
And so, for nearly a decade, the U.S. government's evidence that Al-Qaeda had directed the 9/11 attacks, the very evidence that was used to launch the war on Afghanistan in particular, and America's war of terror in general, was forbidden to the public, hidden behind a cloud of official secrecy. But then, in 2009, IntelWire.com quietly posted a document online under the title Secret Post-9/11 Briefing to World Leaders. The document is a U.S. State Department cable addressed to the American embassies in the NATO countries and American allies around the world under the subject line, September 11, Working Together to Fight the Plague of Global Terrorism and the Case Against Al-Qaeda. The cable is dated October 1, 2001, the day before Ambassador Taylor's meeting with the North Atlantic Council, and instructs its recipients to brief their host country's government on the information linking the Al-Qaeda terrorist network, Osama bin Laden, and the Taliban regime to the September 11th terrorist attack on the World Trade Center and Pentagon and the crash of United Airlines Flight 93. The document went largely unnoticed until earlier this year when Professor Niels Herit wrote an article, The Mysterious Frank Taylor Report, the 9/11 document that launched US-NATO's war on terrorism in the Middle East, connecting the dots between this document and the briefing that Ambassador Taylor gave to the North Atlantic Council.
This is a nice little story about grassroots activism, actually, because it starts in 2009 when I got an email from a Norwegian truth activist. His name is Torstein Vidal, and he sent me this PDF with the message, did you see this? And I hadn't seen this, and I opened it and read it, and it appeared to be the instructions going from the American State Department to all representations in the world, American representations in the world, embassies, consulates, and about what to think and what to say about 9/11. And I did not find the content particularly controversial. This is in 2009. Because what was in there was completely in accordance with the official version. That is nothing, basically. But it was very long, and it was meticulous in instructing the recipients of this depeche, I suppose you call it in English, about what to do with it. Not to put it anywhere, only to use it for oral presentations. But at that time, I did not realize the importance of this document because it weren't until 2012, as I recall, that Michel Kuzodolski came out with a pivotal paper about what happened in Brussels in the days after 9/11. So, still, this document was sitting on my hard drive. But about a year ago, another activist, a brilliant Danish journalist, his name is Tommy Hansen, and he should be mentioned. He's a beacon on our local scene, and unfortunately, he passed away very recently. But I want his name to be mentioned in this connection because when I was talking with Tommy, I said casually that, well, I have the depeche, which was sent to the American representations, about what to say and what to think about 9/11. And I said, well, I would like to see that. All right. So I went back home and dug it out from my archives. And at that moment, for the first time, I looked at the date. Because according to the email address, it had been sent out on October the 2nd. And the document itself is dated on October the 1st. And then it snapped. That what a coincidence. Because this was the same day as when Frank Taylor was giving his presentation in Brussels. And about a day before, all the national governments were briefed. I started to take a closer look. And then some details appeared that was striking. One thing is that Lord Robertson, in his press conference, is reading a section from this document.
The facts are clear and compelling. We know that the individuals who carried out these attacks were part of the worldwide terrorist network, Al-Qaeda, headed by Osama bin Laden and his key lieutenants, and protected by the Taliban.
There, in Lord Robertson's own mouth, at the press conference announcing the delivery of the Taylor Report, are the very words from the document itself. The connection is undeniable. This State Department cable contains the talking points for the briefing that Taylor delivered to the North Atlantic Council. Crucially, if unsurprisingly, the document presents absolutely no proof or evidence establishing a link between Al-Qaeda and 9/11. After spending a full 15 pages talking in generalities about terror, about the U.S. government's officially sanctioned history of Al-Qaeda, and of previous attacks linked to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, the document finally arrives at Part 3, purporting to demonstrate Al-Qaeda's involvement in the attacks. But Part 3 begins by admitting that the investigation into the attacks is still in the early stage, and that there are still gaps in our knowledge. It then goes on to detail circumstantial evidence that would not even rise to the level of warranting an indictment, let alone a conviction in a court of law. After asserting without evidence that several of the alleged hijackers had been identified as known bin Laden associates, without clarifying the source of that identification, let alone how their identities and status as hijackers had been determined, we are then told that bin Laden and his associates seem to be anticipating what we could only identify as an important event or activity. Finally, the document talks about how the incident is tactically similar to earlier attacks, because it involved planning and a desire to inflict mass casualties. And that is it. That is the sum total of the evidence that both the document itself and Lord Robertson, evidently reading notes from Taylor's briefing, calls
clear and compelling.
That this is, in my mind, with no doubt, simply the legal basis for 18 years of perpetual war in the Middle East. This is the basis for NATO's activation of Article 5. And so what is in the document? What is the evidence? What is the evidence which Lord Robertson calls clear and compelling? None. There's absolutely no evidence in that paper. It's free for everyone to see, and I'm sure you'll present it to your audience.
All of this is in keeping with what we have long known about the war on Afghanistan. It was not waged in response to the 9/11 attacks, but was in fact prepared well in advance. Al-Qaeda and the events of September 11th were nothing more than a convenient pretense for the U.S. government to justify their illegal invasion and occupation of a key geostrategic landmass in South Asia. In 1997, just 4 years before the NATO invasion, former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote that, "For America, the chief geopolitical prize is Eurasia. Now a non-Eurasian power is preeminent in Eurasia, and America's global primacy is directly dependent on how long and how effectively its preponderance on the Eurasian continent is sustained." Specifically, Brzezinski pinpointed Afghanistan and its neighbors, an area he called the Eurasian Balkans, as the most geopolitically significant region to control for its gas and oil reserves and mineral deposits. He argued that some form of extended American military intervention in the region would be necessary, warning that a global consensus on its foreign policy imperatives would be impossible, except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. Later that year, a senior delegation from the Taliban came to the United States for meetings with UNICAL about securing the rights for a gas pipeline from Turkmenistan to Pakistan across Afghanistan. In 2002, it was revealed that the United States had been negotiating with the Taliban to secure those oil interests, and that American negotiators had told the Taliban that they had a choice. You have a carpet of gold, meaning an oil deal, or a carpet of bombs. Shortly after the 9/11 attacks, a former Pakistani foreign secretary revealed to the BBC that a senior American official had told him in mid-July of 2001 that military action against Afghanistan would go ahead by the middle of October. When the Bush administration came into office, its first substantive national security decision directive, NSPD 9, called for military options against Taliban targets in Afghanistan, including leadership, command control, air and air defense, ground forces, and logistics, and was presented to the president on September 4, 2001, 7 days before 9/11.
Although this National Security Presidential Directive was originally a highly classified document, we've arranged for portions of it to be declassified to help the Commission in its work, and I will describe some of it today. The strategy set as a goal the elimination of the Al-Qaeda network and threat, and ordered the leadership of relevant U.S. departments and agencies to make the elimination of Al-Qaeda a high priority and to use all aspects of our national power, intelligence, financial, diplomatic, and military, to meet that goal. And it directed the Secretary of Defense to, and I quote, ensure that contingency planning processes include plans against Al-Qaeda and associated terrorist facilities in Afghanistan, including leadership, command control and communications, training and logistics facilities, and against Taliban targets in Afghanistan, including leadership, command control, air and air defense, ground forces and logistics.
Dr. Rice has stated that she asked the National Security Council staff in her first week in office for a new presidential initiative on Al-Qaeda. In early March, the staff was directed to craft a more aggressive strategy aimed at eliminating the Al-Qaeda threat. The first draft of that approach in the form of a presidential directive was circulated by the NSC staff in June of 2001, and a number of meetings were held that summer at the deputy secretary level to address the policy questions involved, such as relating an aggressive strategy against Taliban to U.S.-Pakistan relations. By the first week of September, the process had arrived at a strategy that was presented to principals and later became NSPD 9, the president's first major substantive national security decision directive. It was presented for a decision by principals on September 4th, 2001, 7 days before the 11th, and later signed by the president with minor changes and a preamble to reflect the events of September 11th in October.
The invasion of Afghanistan was not about Al-Qaeda. It was not the response of the U.S. government to the evidence connecting the Taliban to Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda to 9/11 that was missing from Ambassador Taylor's report. It was a geopolitical gambit in search of a justification. And the events of 9/11 were the justification that the U.S. used to sell NATO and the world on the war in Afghanistan. Worse, 9/11 was the excuse for the entire war of terror itself, the complete transformation of the Middle East that is taking place thanks to American military might. The Taylor Report was a blank check drawn on the events of that day, a check that is still being cashed.
That this is the legal and the moral foundation and political foundation for the launch of the uninterrupted destruction of the Middle East. That's what it is. The 18 years of wars, we have refugees running all over the highways in Europe. Europe is going down for the load of refugees and migrants. And it all started there. It all emerges from this single document. legally, morally, and politically.
More to think about. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me.